Welcome, everybody, to the Son of Sam Chronicles, and this is part two of our interview with Dr. Michael Caparelli, who's written a fantastic new book called Monster Mirror. It's available on Amazon and wherever you get books today, Barnes & Noble, etc. There it is. Welcome back, Mike.
Thank you. Good to be back.
I'm going to talk a second here about empathy. Okay, it's a big part of your book. David talks about how he lost empathy, human feeling for people. Okay. And that, you know, caused him to be able to do what he did. Now, do you believe that that's accurate as far as David? Do you believe he's sincere with that? And also, do you think that there is a lack of empathy in this world in general today? What do you think?
The loss of empathy paves the way for violence historically. And we lose empathy the more distant we become. Before the Germans ever escorted the Jews into the concentration camps, into gas chambers, there was a lot of social distancing going on. It was a lot of, stay away. More isolated, more oxytocin levels go down. Oxytocin is the hormone, the chemical that is partly responsible for empathy. If you stay isolated, you lose touch with people, your level of empathy towards them begins to decrease.
Yeah.
We know that empathy short circuits violent impulses. A good example of this is Stanley Milgram's classic experiment where, participants are asked to administer electrical shocks to actors. They don't know they're actors. They think that they're actually being shocked. And it's amazing in Milgram's experiment, the experiment was done in the 50s, right after the war, trying to understand how this happened. World War II inspired many types of experiments like this. And what Milgram found out is that the participants were willing to shock people at extraordinary levels, even to the point of near death. But the difference is that when the participants hold their hands of the ones that he was shocking, all of a sudden, the ability to administer the electrical shock, these actually replications of Milgram's experiment, and they would hold the participants' hands. Once empathy activates, I can't hurt you. And David even tells an interesting story on that. He's in that mindset, Son of Sam, and comes across somebody who needed help. Hears their voice, sound of their voice, empathy is activated, and he can't hurt them. So, this idea of empathy short circuits violent impulses. But to say he lost empathy, not so much that he's lost it completely, more like it seizes up, he gets to a point where things are atrophy, and this atrophy that comes over him, and it's not just David Berkowitz, but it's really the general population, you find it easier to hurt people. When we're not in touch, you hear somebody's story, you get to know them, it becomes very difficult to inflict injury on people we know.
Right. But do you feel that in the world today, given we live in a society of mass shootings and that the United States is kind of alone in that in the world, that we as a country, we experience this phenomenon of kids killing kids and, school shootings, mass shootings, a lack of empathy. What do you think is the main cause of that today?
Well, I had an interesting experience. One of my students in my psychology class is from Africa, in Kenya. And I took him to meet David Berkowitz.
Really?
Well, I got a lot of students that take in psychology, abnormal psych, criminal psych. They know the case study. They want to meet David. They want to see, his conversion. So this kid, he's 20, his name is Edward. We're driving towards the prison, and he says to me, I'm from Africa. He said, we don't see mass shootings, serial killings. Of course, there's tribal ritualistic violence. But we don't see it like you do. And we began to talk, and he told me how communal his country is. He said, when I got married, the entire community, people I don't even know, it's just part of the custom. Celebrate my wedding. He said, very communal. the collectivist country. America is an individualistic country. You will find these kinds of crimes are more prevalent in individualistic countries where social ties are very weak, and you'll find less prevalence of these crimes in collectivist countries where the communal ties are strong. Wherever there's strong communal ties, there's a greater flow of empathy.
Question on that. Do you think it's possible as well that it's a socioeconomic issue? In other words, in Kenya, you know, in certain areas of Kenya, I'm sure there are areas where people are concerned about where their next meal is going to come from, right? In America, we're well fed. You know, we've got clothes. You know, we don't really have that much to worry about, you know? I mean, if we need a doctor, we can go see one. They'll bill us, whatever, you know? Generally, that's a block away from our house in some cases. When you look at I'm sure in Kenya you don't see people questioning their sexuality or their gender as much either. I guess ultimately what I'm asking you is, can it be just a plain fact that their worries change their wants, needs, and desires so much that they're not even thinking about this type of stuff, about how bad they feel about their lives to go do something so heinous? You know,
I think you make a great point. I think any culture that's too pampered. We're a very pampered culture.
Yeah.
Very mollycoddled, indulgent. Right. We're selfish.
Okay.
So our feelings are hurt easier, easily offended, more entitled. Anytime you have a culture that's as pampered as we are, morality descends. So I think you're having the money, Chris.
Okay. I couldn't agree with that more. I mean, you know, I'm a big history buff. I read a lot, and I see this as almost like a decline of an empire,
mm-hmm.
okay, that we're in. All right, great empires. You've heard this before. They don't get conquered and destroyed from the outside. They rot from the inside.
Happened to
Rome, Greece. Happened to the biggest empires in the world that aren't here anymore. They rotted from the inside, and I think that there's a rot now in America. Now you can come up with all kinds of theories as to why this rot is there, but it is there. Okay. And we do see mass shootings. We do see mass killings. We do see, and getting back to in the last part that we had 2 weeks ago when we talked is isolation. People that are on social media, but they're still isolated. They can't relate to each other. And all of that, in my opinion, and you're the expert, Mike, is it's going to lead to some kind of violent outburst, violent behavior. It's really kind of sad to see this happening, and everyone is like not seeing it. The people that need to see it aren't seeing it. Okay, me and you, we're seeing it. Okay, but the powers that be don't see it, and they keep going down the same road. You mentioned in the last episode about how, we talked about demonic possession and how it's not considered today, and that the therapy that people are experiencing today, it's not working because they don't consider that. Now, I don't need to bring up demonic possession again, but it's like we're only experiencing, I don't know how to say it exactly, but it's like we're not at 100% in where we could be.
I agree completely. I mean, I personally believe that a society cannot run smoothly without some foundation of, call it religion, call it moral absolutes. And when you abandon those absolutes, G.K. Chesterton once said this. He said that the problem with not believing in absolutes is not that it leads to a belief in nothing. The problem is that it leads to a belief in anything.
Anything. Yes.
So once we abandon absolutes, we deconstruct stuff that maybe 50 years ago, 75 years ago, it was a given. It was understood. We fear God. We will give an account for the life we live. That is understood. You deconstruct those absolutes, It's not a lethal belief in nothing.
Right.
Believe
in anything.
A permissiveness that we're seeing in our culture. And, you know, David, it's interesting because David didn't grow up in this era. He grew up in the 70s.
Yes.
But sociologically, right after the hippie movement, you know, Vietnam, there was a lot of good in the hippie movement. A lot of legitimate challenges of authority. I'm not saying it's all garbage.
Right.
But there was this feeling in the 70s, David describes it often, this upheaval. This moral upheaval. Nobody really knows what to believe. A distrust towards government, distrust towards authority. He said that there was also this sense of scattering, especially more regional in the Bronx. People were leaving his neighborhood, going into other neighborhoods. He feels alone. So there's a lot of, you know, the foundations are being dismantled, and it creates this instability. And David, being the kind of guy he was, being very sensitive, a lot of psychological issues. He used to listen to a particular song on the regular called Eve of Destruction. And you listen to that song.
Yeah. Harry Maguire.
Yes. I didn't even really know much about the song until
he
told me to go listen to it. I remember sitting with him in all the sessions, singing to the lyrics. I mean, he knew all the lyrics of the song. And he said it gave me the sense that the death was at the doorway. Any second, the world was going to be destroyed. Freud said that we have two instincts. We have a self-preserving instinct, and we have thanatos, which is the death instinct. And it's this instinct to destroy, not just destroy ourselves, but destroy others. And that death instinct, thanatos, and typically, if you see it rear its head, like, for instance, jihadists, in some countries where it's destruction all the time. That was David's mindset. He felt like he was living in the midst of this upheaval, and it watching the news constantly, the news junk, constantly seeing on the news, Vietnam. Now, of course, he himself went to war, the constant reports of riots, race riots, political turmoil, and then his own family, his mom died, his father moved to Florida. He just felt like he was living in an upheaval, and that upheaval contributed to his instability.
Now, okay, and definitely the late 60s and into the 70s, there was a lot of upheaval. I can understand how he would feel that way. But what about today? Okay, now David watches the news, I'm sure, from his jail cell. Okay, and, you know, what does he think of some of the major issues today? What, you know, that's going on? Just curious.
David's very compassionate and concerned about youth. Probably as closest to his heart.
Yeah.
The impetus behind him telling his story is he's hoping some young, troubled person, maybe right at the cusp of the Columbine, is going to pick up the book, read it, relate to him, and in relating to him, also find an escape, just like he found an escape. He's hoping the book will reach some troubled, you know, 18 to 25-year-old, because let's face it, that age range,
no,
more suicide, more car accidents, more. I mean, it's such an aimless period of time. Like, you leave school, you're 18, you've had years and years of institutionalization, you know, a routine every day. You know, in some cases, you're 18, like in David's case, your friends have moved on. It's such an aimless time. He's hoping the book, to answer the question, will reach that young person exactly where he was between 18 to 24 years old.
Right. Think about what we just went through with that whole isolation during COVID, during the whole shutdown. Think how many people.
Yeah,
I think all this mental disease and all this craziness because these people were in their houses for too long.
You know what, Rob? You nailed it. I mean, all the therapists that I know, and I know many of them. By the way, let me say this: I'm not a therapist. I'm a PhD, not a psyche.
Yes.
I'm on the science side, the research, the study side. I'm not on the practicing counseling side. I got to say that because my emails blow up after venues like this.
Yeah.
It's somewhere, you know, I speak in 18 states a year, churches, prisons, universities. It's always an email. Can you counsel my kid? I don't do counseling, but to your point, Rob, every counselor I know, they tell me, Mike, there's not enough. There's not enough therapists to keep up with the demand.
I can absolutely attest to that.
Skyrocket.
Yeah.
Mike, I want to ask you a question. You talked about the institutionalization of children, and then they become 18 to 25, and that's where you see this uptick in deaths. Are you saying I made it out of 18 to 25 because I cut class all the time? I'm just curious. Is that possible? Because I had no structure at all whatsoever. I just want to throw that out there. And if that's why I'm still alive today, I want to call my mother right after we get off the phone.
That's funny.
I mean, Mike, I just want to say I can attest to exactly what you're saying about there not being enough therapists and stuff related to what we've experienced in the last few years. I mean, my wife is a mental health counselor. I think I mentioned that to you. And, the story she tells me, people are still dealing with COVID, even though it's been done for a couple of years already, all the lockdowns, there's relationship issues, there's coping issues, there's all these things related to that isolation that people experience. I think, and I'm just going to throw this in there, we don't have to get into it because it's a whole other topic, but when we were doing conspiracy shows, me and Rob, when COVID was just breaking out, I think how I coped with it, and maybe Rob, you'll agree, is we didn't believe half the shit that was being said. Okay. Yeah. Now we don't have to go into all that, but I'm just saying that was how I coped with it. I was like, I don't know if I really, okay. Yeah. I'm seeing people die, but it's just not quite the way that they're depicting it. And I don't want to believe this. And, I re-listened to some of those shows a couple months ago and, I listened to myself. I said, okay, we didn't know everything that was going on yet, but I was just dismissing this thing because I had a feeling what was coming before it even happened. So that's got to be some kind of coping mechanism, right? What you say?
For sure. Yeah, no.
Mike, I got a question for you about David.
Just find it out real quick.
Sorry. Yeah.
Fear is a contagion. Studies have been done that when people are walking through a haunted house,
right,
the level of hysteria often matches how many people are in the group. So if the group is larger, there's more hysteria. If it's two people walking through a haunted house, there's very minimal hysteria because fear is contagious.
It feeds off each other.
Yeah, it's called mirror neurons. The neurons in the brain that mirror and reflect back other people's behaviors. And so if you laugh, I laugh. You cry, I cry. If you yawn, I yawn.
Yeah.
I walk into the room, everybody's clapping. I start clapping. I don't even know why I'm clapping. It's contagious. So that fear, that contagion, that was the biggest problem, I believe, during 2020, 2021.
Absolutely.
More than the disease, I'm not saying it wasn't a disease, but more than the disease itself was this fear, this contagion that, let me tell you, fear perpetuated anxiety, depression, paranoia, schizophrenia. 251 neurotic and psychotic disorders listed in the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, and fear is probably at the root and the core of most of those psychotic and neurotic disorders.
I definitely can see that. Just changing gears here for a second.
I got one question here.
Go ahead, Chris.
Sorry, guys.
Go ahead.
You briefly touched on David going to Vietnam.
Korea.
He went to Korea. He went to Korea during Vietnam. I apologize.
Yeah, 2.5 in Korea, 1.5 homeland.
Right. What I'm more concerned about is Kentucky. Mm-hmm. How much did you talk to David about that part of his life, the Kentucky piece? In a lot of research I've done on David, it's kind of murky what really happened in Kentucky. I'm wondering if there's anything you can expand upon. I believe based on what I've read that he went through some sort of mental health treatment during that time period. And that there was also, a conversion of sorts, kind of going towards Christianity You know, did you touch on that at all with him? I mean, what was his thoughts from back during that time? Maybe looking back 40 or 50 years later, however long ago that was. I mean,
good question, man. Good question.
Yeah, he was very lonely. He'd gone into the Army, very patriotic. You know, when he was at Columbus High School, he wasn't a part of the hippie crowd. He was one of the few that was more of a flag waver than a tree hugger.
Right.
He decided to be part of that small minority of patriots. So he had this patriotic streak, but he also had a desire for camaraderie.
Sure.
The military, you know, was hoping would provide him with that camaraderie. He also, you know, I talk about in the book, it's known as the MAOA gene, we call it the psychopath gene. It's actually a gene that some scientists link with psychopathy. The criminal population, geneticists will say a lot of them have the MAOA gene. It's this gene in you that you want adventure. You're more willing to take some risks. Like David had the kind of personality that he would have gladly jumped out of a plane. You know, he just had that take it to the line, extreme personality.
Sure.
Desire to go in the military kind of fed that. By the way, not everybody with MAOA gene is a psychopath. You've got some people that join the military and become fighter pilots. And they've got that same aggressive type personality, willing to put it all out on the line.
Right.
David's in the military looking, you know, to be a patriot, represent his country because he loves his country, find some camaraderie. You know, like I said, he's an adventurous kind of personality, but he finds himself disappointed. He's there. The camaraderie's not happening the way he expected to happen. One day a bus shows up on a Sunday morning and says, you know, want to go to church? And he's very lonely, so he gets on the bus, goes to Beth Haven, meets Pastor Tim Waller.
Yep.
He did, for a little while, he did feel a sense of camaraderie within the church, but quickly he began to realize that the church in the Bible Belt was not exactly what he was accustomed to in New York City.
No, he was probably more accustomed to Catholic.
A lot of culture, a lot of, you know, ethnicities. You know, they're very parochial in their worldview in the South. And some offensive things were said about Jews that kind of took him back.
Yeah.
But he did have what he would call an experience with God during that time. Right. It was holy. He did have somewhat of an experience. It didn't really take root in him. It was more about the social, the fitting in, finding a family, than it was about him and the Almighty.
Yeah.
So, you know, yes, he did have a religious experience, but kind of shallow, not enough to really make that lasting change. That didn't happen until 1988 when he was in Sullivan.
Right.
Experiment with substance, not to any extreme level. I mean, I know there's some theories out there that he took some LSD or some hallucinogenic and that was it. That's not the truth. He did experiment. Yes, he admits that.
Yeah.
But not to this point where there was some bad acid trip. And
yeah, no,
blame it on that acid trip.
You can have a spiritual experience on acid. I mean, it's that's been pretty well documented. But I guess I'm really interested in his mental health experience there as well. I mean, he was definitely in some sort of therapy while he was there. That's correct, right? When he got to Kentucky. Am I right about that? I could be wrong. I mean, do you have any knowledge of that? Do you know what it was for? Was it for the isolationism, if you do know about it, or was it regarding something else? Because that's a really murky chain of events in his life. And I think, you know, based on my own research, and I don't have the same research that you have, based on my own research, it seems like there's something important that happened there aside from the spiritual stuff. In that mental health facility, there's something that triggered, I want to say, was either a trigger point or, you know, I don't know, or something that happened previously in Korea that got him to Kentucky into that mental health facility in the Army barracks. Is there anything that you can expand on in terms of that part of his life?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, he's disconnected from Matt, his father. adopted father. Nat is an anchor in his life. Even though he pushed Nat away for many years, Nat's presence to David was a real source of stability. When Nat moved to Florida and David came home to New York, that pushed David over the edge. Now, when I say it pushed him over the edge, David had his own problems. He takes full responsibility, not blaming on his father. He loved his father. But he just felt real isolated. Dad, Nat, his voice of clarity, voice of encouragement, really kept David anchored. In fact, Nat spent years regretting the move to Florida. You know, hindsight. He didn't know in his older
years. And he would react that way.
He didn't know in his younger years, but he knew in his older years. He looked back and said, man, what I do. But he spent a lot of time beating himself up because he gets remarried and moves. So David's in the army. He's disconnected from that source of stability. He writes a lot of letters to his dad while he's in the military because he's missing him. And that's a rock for him. That is an anchor for David. The second thing is, you know, David, any attempt that he did make in therapy was very perfunctory. There were a lot of people throughout his life that said, look, the kid needs help.
Okay.
Signs of a mental breakdown. You know, even at a young age, 7-8 years old, episodes in the classroom, seeing Mrs. Dostoff, therapist in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. But he's very perfunctory. He's kind of going through emotions. Never really, it's more other people that are getting him to go to the therapy than it is he himself participating in it. And the therapist back then was not like what?
Therapy today, right.
They didn't have the education then that we have now. They didn't really know how to navigate through some of the things that they're probably seeing in those offices with David. The mental health system back then, if it's broken now, it was hardly existing then. It was more of a coercion of other people than it was David's willingness.
They didn't give him any electroshock treatment there, did he?
I never heard of him.
Okay. Good. Just curious. Just curiosity. Oh.
Let me ask you this, Mike. You know, you describe in the book, actually it's David's words, that he was often shamed by his teachers, members of his family or friends, all those variety of things. Even his appearance, that he was a little overweight and things like that. People teased him about that, shamed him about that. How much did that affect his psyche into what he did?
Shame is, I mean, my goodness, it's such a powerful force. In fact, before I answer the question with David specifically, I'll give you a historical reference.
Sure.
You know, when Hitler came into power, Germany was a country that had been humiliated.
Yes.
Come out of World War One, they had signed a treaty and an agreement basically owning responsibility for the war, and saying we're the culprits behind
reparations.
Having to pay reparations. I mean, Germany was the laughing stock of the world. And Hitler, being master manipulator, knew he could whip that shame up into rage. But there's a very fine line between shame and rage. When people feel humiliated and they've been shamed, it's a scary thing what could happen. The way shame is like taking a beach ball and you push it down into the water. You know, when you're shamed, you push down, right? Insults, ridicule, and you push that beach ball down and you let go. What happens?
It goes right up.
It thrusts up with, it doubles up in power. It'll hit you in the face. So that's a picture of shame and its connection to violence, which I'll cite studies in the book on the relationship between shame and violence. David's case has been shamed for a long time. Some of it was probably perceived in his own head, and some of it wasn't just mentality, but reality. He had an uncle that would often make comments about his weight. His uncle was very fit, very athletic. In fact, David kind of said, it didn't say this callous, but he says, interesting, my uncle was constantly shaming me for being fat and, calling me names. And the guy's jogging all the time and he dies of a heart attack while he's jogging.
That's crazy. That's ironic.
Ooh, kind of ironic, yeah. But David did a lot of shame. He got teachers that, you know, he's misbehaving in the class. They don't know what to do. The teacher puts his desk in the center of the class, him along with two other students, You know, you got a class in New York City, what, 50, 60 students, maybe more in the class. And you got three kids in the middle. These are the three rascals.
Yeah.
So he's branded in his mind as this derelict, rascal, you know, just, so he accepted that self-image. That self-image played a big role in who he became.
I mean, how did he react to the drill? I mean, I'm thinking about the drill instructors and when he first got into basic training. That must have destroyed a guy like him. Because I bet you, I'm Mike, I'm looking at Mike, and I think you want to say what I was about to say is, and probably you too, Mike, because we all went through some sort of shaming or isolation or
we all experienced that. Yeah.
Why don't we become killers, right? What stops us short of doing something so heinous and doing it over and over and over again in our lives until we get caught by chance?
Can I answer that before Mike does?
Yes, please.
I can tell you what it is for me, and I think Mike, you'll agree. Some belief in a higher power, God, okay? Some kind of like repercussion for what you might want to do, okay? And say, man, if I do this, I'm going to be in big trouble with the God, okay? Right. So, you know, I think that because we have that background, Chris, you know, Rob, you have that background. I think whether you live it or not, I think we have that background. And I think that has something to do. What do you think, Dr. Mike?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that point. John Bradford, who was a Puritan, you know, back in England, I want to say like, I don't know, 16, 1700s, for the Bradford family that came over to the Mayflower. John Bradford once, I think, recorded in his diary, there was a prisoner and he was being hauled to his execution publicly, like they often did. Everyone's screaming names at the prisoner, you know, calling him whatever the terms were for monster back then. And John Bradford looked at the prisoner and he said, "There, but for the grace of God, go on." That statement became a very popular statement. What it basically meant was, I'm not much different than that guy right there. If it wasn't for the grace of God on my life, all I can say is amazing grace. I would have easily gone down that same direction. Mm-hmm. So I do believe the reality of God is a restraining force. David, you know, if you study his letters, I'm sure some of you've seen the website,
yeah,
you know, the big drop, I've heard it referred to, of data. You see in his letters a hatred for.
Mike, you got muted.
You got muted, Mike.
The host.
You're okay. Go ahead.
Okay. If you look at a lot of David's letters in the military during SOS, even younger, or in prison in Attica, you'll see this animosity towards God.
Yes.
I actually believe a lot of animosity towards God is another, you know, part of this. You're disconnecting from the source of all life. And the only power that can restrain us, it can be a real setup and disaster.
Yeah, I got that from him as well. But I guess you look through it through your own lens. And I, growing up, you know, Roman Catholic, God was everywhere. You could have put something on the table because God was on the table. You didn't do this because God was watching. God's going to punish you. Mm-hmm. And you know, I never made me hate God. You know what I mean? But for David, it seemed like all the things that his adopted mother was telling him about God almost made him resentful of God. And that is one of the most interesting things I ever took from this research, by the way, because I'm like, why is this bothering him so much? I mean, it's what every mother says, you know? And he grew up around Italian kids, so I'm sure it was like they were hearing the same thing from their mother back then, you know? I don't
know. The Italian factor, too, you know, he laughs, him and I, all the time. Because obviously I'm Italian, Jewish, and you know, we go back and forth, we joke a lot on that subject. But you know, growing up, it wasn't a joke. His Italian friends, one of them brought him home, meets mom, and mom says, "How dare you bring that Jew?"
Matzo Kris, right?
What is it?
Matzo Kris. That's what they say. You hear that term a lot amongst Italians.
Yeah.
Okay. In my own church, we go through this. We go through the, you can't be anti-Semitic and love God and love and accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior. You cannot do the two things.
Right.
And I've watched people stumble on this, but I tell them when you're in a room with Italians is when the Jews got pushed out of Spain in the 1500s, Medici family accepted them into Italy. You know what they brought? Tomatoes. So think about that. But what I see that in jest, but it's the truth. You know, I I'm sorry that he had to go through that, but you know, I think to an extent, people in the Christian faith have to do a better job of teaching that anti-Semitism is bad no matter which way you cut it.
Let me say this too, the fact that we really haven't highlighted, because I David would say what I'm going to say. All the circumstances we're discussing, none of it gets him off the hook. He made a series of choices.
Right. Hit
many intersections and chose to go down the wrong path. Chose
right.
Left, right. And, you know, you keep making these choices and you look at a lot of these intersections in the book. You know, choices, you sow an act, you reap a tendency. You sow a tendency, you reap a habit. You sow a habit, you reap a characteristic. You sow a characteristic, you reap a destiny. So free will, choices, you make. I mean, it's snowball. It's a momentous effect. That's another one of those distinguishing factors. I mean, there were points in time. I came to the same intersections that David came to. And, you know, but for the grace of God, I chose a different path. But if I had, in quotes, I could have taken another path that would have taken me a lot further than I ever dreamed of going.
Right. Okay. All right. And with that, I think I'd like to wind down this last episode with Mike. I know your time's a little bit limited. The last question that I have is basically, what is your future with David now? The book is done. It's out. And will you continue to visit him, keep in touch? And could there be another book?
I enjoyed the journey with him so much that I probably will do more books potentially with him.
Wow.
And also within the prison.
Okay.
I've thought about other people that come from the same kind of background as David and committed the same, you know, types of crimes and have had major conversions in prison. I've thought about sending those individuals with notoriety, people's names, if I drop them, you know them, sending them a copy of the book. I think that these kinds of stories are fascinating. They challenge some of the cultural deception, ideologies that I think that need to be challenged in our day and age. One of them is cancel culture, which makes me cringe. You know, this idea that certain groups of people are irredeemable.
Yeah.
And, you know, we take this moral high horse, and I believe in redemption. I believe in the redemption of David Berkowitz. Not a perfect man, but I believe in his redemption. More of these kinds of redemption stories. Not saying people like him to get out of prison. Not saying that.
Right.
What I am saying is those redemption stories are very appropriate or needed in this hour. So yeah, I probably will do more books. I'm not sure if it means doing it more with David, but I'm open to that idea. I'll continue visiting him. We have a friendship at this point. But yeah, you can definitely expect more from me in the subject.
That's good to hear. I'm glad. Looking forward to that if you do that. Any more questions, guys?
Yeah. You mentioned in you know previously when we were talking about growth, kind of piggybacking off of what Mike just asked you about, you know, what's the, you know, the next phase of your relationship with David. You know, I assume as a friend of David's, You want to see more growth out of him, right? I mean, what do you want to see out of him as a man? I mean, no one's completely fully grown, but I mean, is there anything in the realm of his past and his present that you would wish would shape up a little bit better? Is there a type of growth you're looking for in David, or do you not really? Are you indifferent?
Yeah, I like to see David embrace, this is going to sound like a surprise to you, it's going to sound like I'm contradicting myself, but I'm not. There are levels to this. Embrace more of God's mercy and grace. David really struggles with the weight of his crimes every day. I have seen him sob. I've seen him sob. I don't mean like light cry. And I don't mean like manufactured cry. I mean the kind of cry you just can't manufacture. I've seen him sob over the crimes that were committed. And I know he lives under a tremendous weight of guilt and shame. Of course, he believes in the cross. He believes he's forgiven. Believes that in his head. Sometimes there's a big distance between the head and the heart. And him feeling forgiven, him knowing he's forgiven, there's a distance there. So I want to see him experience more of that mercy and grace. Now, maybe it's God's will for his life that he lives to a certain degree under the weight of what he did. Maybe that's part of the, you know, God's treatment for him is to live under that. I mean, the lives that ended, tragically ended. I think of Stacy Moskowitz and I think of victims of SOS and my heart breaks. I mean, I've got daughters. I've got young girls. They're in their 20s now. My youngest is going to be 18. And so when I think of the weight of that, just me thinking of it vicariously, it's heavy. I can't imagine being involved in that. And having that weigh on you. So to see David find some freedom emotionally, I'd like to see that happen. Not to get him off the hook, but just to see him experience more of the mercy and grace of Jesus Christ, that would definitely make me happy.
All right. That's a great, great question there, Chris. I've got one more.
Sure.
We've mentioned all the serial killers previous podcasts. We've mentioned previous serial killers on this show, or at least in the previous talk we had. Why are David's murders so much different from people like Ted Bundy and Gacy and some of those other guys that we've mentioned in the past, Dahmer even? Those murderers seem to do it in a much more sadistic, up close and personal, bloody way. David Berkowitz, it almost feels like a mafia hit, you know? I mean, I hate to... Rob, we've said that three or four times. What is it between David Berkowitz and those other men?
Well, to use criminology terms, you know, the way criminologists divide the category killings, there are process killings and there are event killings. David Berkowitz's crimes would be considered an event killing versus a process killing. It's one and done. Process, the perpetrator spends lots of time with the victim, usually because of a more sadistic streak. I don't know if I classify, and I listen, there are going to be people that take what I'm going to say, and they're going to take it the wrong way.
But understood.
You're not hearing what I'm saying in context. If you do take what I say the wrong way. The level of sadism behind the Son of Sam shootings is not the same as the level of sadism Ted Bundy spending hours
right
with the victim,
Jeffrey Dahmer
cannibalizing.
I mean, even
process killings versus event killings.
Even in John Douglas's book, or not book, but even in the Netflix movie that's kind of like a documentary, they couldn't really classify Berkowitz as a serial killer in the way that they were classifying all those other men that they were talking to. Mm-hmm. There is that, at least that piece in there. Funny enough, the doctor's name is Carr, who was doing that, but we'll get to that's for another show. Nonetheless, I don't know. It's just that's the weirdest thing that always drew me to this.
You could probably draw a closer comparison to David Berkowitz and some of your mass shooters. That's why I keep referencing mass shooters. Even though the Son of Sam crimes weren't, Son of Sam murders, tragedies weren't mass shootings in the sense that it was going into a mall or a school and, you know, many at once. It was the same profile. And by the way, David was very close to pulling off a mass shooting. So,
right. Had he not been arrested.
Had he not been arrested. So he's probably more the old David prior to conversion. Probably more in that caliber, that genre of killings than the Ted Bundy's.
That definitely makes a lot of sense, Mike.
I never even thought about that.
Yeah. All right. So just want to tell everybody again, Monster Mirror by Dr. Mike Caparelli. It's available. There it is. A hardcover version. available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere that's got books. Look it up. And just want to thank you again, Mike, taking time to come on our little Son of Sam Chronicles show. You know, you're going to be doing some great national stuff and things like that with this book. And, you know, we wish you all the best with every endeavor you do. Okay?
Appreciate you guys being so fair, so open. I mean, it was just, I had a great time the last episode. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for watching the Son of Sam Chronicles with Dr. Mike Caparelli. Last two episodes. Stay tuned for another one soon. We're coming back.
Thanks, guys.
Walkway right here to my left and went through a hole in the fence and committed this murder. Now he didn't get